September 22nd, 1923. Once again, debris closes in on Asakusa Park, Tokyo. This wasn't another earthquake, no. There was one just 3 weeks ago. Today, people knew what to expect from the announcements in newspapers and flyers. They were to stay clear of the park. Military engineers clutched dynamite sticks in their hands and in the early morning began the arduous process of bringing down whatever remained of Japan's first skyscraper, the Ryōgunkaku. If only the building wasn't built so strongly, if only everything had obediently fallen to the ground when the earth shook, just like the rest of Asakusa. But the Ryōgunkaku would not have this. It was one stubborn tower that was from its birth determined to stand out unsympathetically, even in times of disaster. Its insides were completely emptied out by the quake, but most of its red brick 12-story tall outer structure remained awkwardly intact. Reduced to a shell, it was damaged beyond repair. It was thoroughly vacated. But still, this poster child of Japan's modernity wasn't ready to give up on its place in the city. It was still the tallest structure in post-quake Tokyo, if not in the whole of Japan. And so it took an entire day and the entire 7th Battalion of military engineers to take it down with explosives. Against official instructions, many people still flocked to the debris-covered Asakusa to watch the tower's gradual but certain demise. The tower was proud. Once again, it was the spectacle, the center of attention. May 5th, 1889. The Exposition Universelle opens in Paris. Never mind that Japan's pavilion for the World Fair, a simple one-story temple, received less fanfare than the newly unveiled Eiffel Tower, or the Javanese gamelan ensemble that the Dutch had seized from its East Indies. Meiji officials were confident that the world would be equally amazed the following year when Japan unveiled its own Eiffel Tower. Construction for the Ryōgunkaku, or the pavilion that soars above the clouds, was almost complete. Although only a sixth of the Eiffel Tower's height, the 52-meter octagonal tower was enough to be the tallest building in Japan. The tower was to symbolize Japan's successful attempts at modernization, and so from its design to construction, was to be Western through and through. In line with the Meiji government's habit of haphazardly hiring foreign advisors, one Scottish sanitary engineer, William Burton, was entrusted with the designing of the building in 1887, not long after he had arrived in Japan for the first time. In the early stages of construction, the tower was no different from traditional Japanese houses. Everything, from its foundation, pillars, to flooring, was constructed out of wood in various forms: planks, straw, tree bark, paper, nails, and so on. Laborers cautiously climbed up wooden staircases, carrying woods of various shapes and sizes on their backs. Suspended above ground, they toiled away, meticulously piecing together pre-cut wood boards. All of this building activity went on within a wooden enclosure of support frames and beams, which stabilized the emergent structure and its craftsmen as it grew from within, like a fetus. Wood was in abundance and people knew how to work with it. But wood was also falling out of fashion. It was too antiquated, too everyday, and simply too Japanese. And so in this supposedly Western building, wood was to be invisible from the outside, invisible to the public. And when it seemed like the basic wooden structure within had finally matured, laborers tore away at the wooden womb and replaced it with a shell of bricks. Thick, bright red, almost too uniformly and almost too neatly shaped. Bricks held together by laboriously mixed cement and painfully molded ductile metallic wires. With this, the tower stood out at Asakusa Park throughout the year. Today, November 10th is celebrated as Elevator Day in Japan. But it really should have been November 11th. Because in 1890, the opening of Japan's first electric elevator within Ryōgunkaku was pushed back by a day when guests of honour could not make it on the 10th. The elevator dipped ever more slightly as it was loaded up with people. Once the elevator doors were completely sealed, engines buzzed noisily and sent vibrations through its body. Gears spun, sometimes creaking. Pulleys hoisted, sometimes squeaking. And metal ropes tugged at the elevator with all their might. On its way from the 2nd to 7th floor, the elevator passes by some 40 stores selling a standard assortment of luxury goods from all over the world. European timepieces, lamps, thermometers, writing equipment, umbrellas, and so on and so forth. On the 8th floor, prying open the elevator doors, one steps into a spacious lounge with two doors. One leads into a musical hall where Western music concerts are held, while the other leads into an art exhibition space where photographs of geisha are displayed. If most visitors weren't already overwhelmed by their newfound sense of vertical freedom as their bodies were magically lifted into the air in a metal box, they were surely in for a transformative visual experience as they climbed up the stairs from the 8th floor up to the observation decks on the 10th, 11th and 12th floors. Once there, behind the safe transparency of long glass windows, all of Tokyo, and on a clear day even Fujisan, and even all of Japan could be seen. Like the Eiffel Tower, Ryokaku satisfied the late 19th century desire for a new way of seeing. Seeing from above. It enabled visitors to reimagine Tokyo and Japan. They not only grasped however much they could of the messy metropolitan agglomeration that now appeared clearly before their eyes, but also took in Japan's newfound position in the world, elevated, modern, and civilized. Postcards immortalized Ryokaku from its birth in 1890. On these small, handy pulpwood surfaces, the immaculately printed and vibrantly colored tower took up a permanent, endlessly reproducible material presence for itself, as a de facto symbol of Japanese modernity. Yet these postcards mostly circulated amongst curious tourists and visitors to the city. They never found themselves in the hands of Tokyo's own metropolitan residents. For Tokyoites who had seen their fair share of 4 to 5 story buildings in the city, and indeed there were relatively tall Buddhist pagodas at the same Asakusa district, the tower was but just another regular structure, only just 2 to 3 times taller than usual. For them, the tower did not float, contrary to what its official name Ryokaku suggested, with its allusion to clouds and to the celestial heavenscape. As the hype surrounding the tower died down soon after its opening, and as many Tokyoites found it sufficient to ascend the tower once and never again after, Tokyoites came to refer to the tower as simply Jiunikai, or literally 12 steps or 12 floors. The tower may be the tallest in Japan, but even it was finite, spared neither from people's short-lived attention spans, nor from the common worldly denomination for measuring height, kai. The magical incantation that made the tower mundane, trivial, and not that magical after all. Kai, kai, kai. In 1924, less than a year after the big earthquake, writer Akutagawa Ryunosuke does not mention Jiunikai or Ryokaku even once in his nostalgia-charged piece on Asakusa. For Akutagawa, Asakusa at the turn of the 20th century was instead all about its Misemonokoya. Misemonokoya, that is, the little exhibition houses that dotted Asakusa streets, whose vibrant street-level activities disappear from sight and from hearing atop the Ryokaku. In these houses, visitors pay a small sum to enter the koya, or small house, and he did so to see Misemono, or things worth showing and seeing. Vague. Very vague. But it was precisely this vagueness that enhanced the appeal of Misemonokoya. What was worth seeing in these informally organized spaces was forever changing, and the offerings of one Misemonokoya differed drastically from that of another just down the road. Equally vague and unclear are the historical beginnings of Misemonokoya. From very early on, it appears that things that were worth seeing and showing in Misemonokoya were constituted precisely in opposition to more orthodox and disciplined forms of aesthetic practices. In an early 1600s, for instance, Misemonokoya in Edo, or modern Tokyo, housed any entertainment form that was not classical dance drama in the Kabuki tradition. This included casual dancing, singing, puppet shows, and magic shows. Forever, the negativity to that which is considered high culture, Misemonokoya are highly versatile spaces with indeterminate contents. By the early 20th century, the Misemonokoya had drawn inspiration from other entertainment forms like zoos, circuses, and art and museum galleries. And so visitors to Misemonokoya in Asakusa could see rare animals. Or maybe not, maybe just pictures of animals. Well, one wouldn't be sure until one paid and entered. And this uncertainty was perhaps the fun of it all. Visitors could also maybe see acrobatic performers, or their pictures, or not, or realistic anthropomorphic sculptures, or not, or historically significant material artifacts like classical coinage, or pictures of them, or not, or more commonly a mixture of all of the above, or not. Nisei Monokoya were unpredictable and fun, while Junikai, with its one-time-is-enough observatory decks, and with its standard yet unnecessarily expensive shopping and entertainment options, was not. Among the people who had gathered before whatever was left of the Ryōgunkaku that morning to watch its passing, some of them, undoubtedly, were mourning and sobbing away at the impending loss of Japan's modernity. To these people, the tower was thankful, and it died, I think, a reckless but ultimately peaceful death. Authors and artists were always fascinated with the entertainment district that was Asakusa, though no one really saw that tall, bright red tower that rose from Asakusa as a worthy enough subject for writing. It was only in the late 1920s, when the Junikai had been forcibly laid to rest for over 6 years, when most of Asakusa had been reconstructed, and when most of Tokyo and eastern Japan had been rebuilt, that the tower, now a spectral trace, made its debut on the literary page. On these new Showa-era pulpit surfaces, however, the tower was a sign of an outmoded Meiji-era style of modernity, whose death, in retrospect, could not have been more welcomed. Junikai was the symbol of old Asakusa. The new Asakusa of the 1930s is to be about eroticism and nonsense and speed and comic strip humor of current events and jazz songs and ladies' legs and... writes Yasunari Kawabata. He adds, the giant holding his ground as the last defense of the age of Meiji brick had fallen disemboweled, and then came the age of feral concrete, the age of jazz, the talkie, the proletarian literature, the... The tower must have long known that it will one day fall, and when it did fall, it was pleased, perhaps even pleasantly surprised that it had lived that long. Only 4 years after its opening, the tower narrowly escaped death. Tremors in 1894 had significantly weakened the tower's structure. Officials then, however, chose to save it, and promptly reinforced the tower's structure with steel griddles. The tower's first encounter with death, it seemed, came much earlier. Indeed, there is a sense that the tower should not have been built in the first place. And so, we could say that the specter of its demise first flashed up precisely at the same moment when its ill-advised design and construction began in the late 1880s, when Meiji bureaucrats entrusted the tower to a Scottish who wasn't especially knowledgeable, it seems, of Japan's proclivities to tremble. When towers fall.